Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sippy Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with P.K. Adams about her latest mystery novel, Midnight Fire. In my last interview with her, we discussed her two-part series on the 12th century German musician, physician, and theologian Hildegard of Bingen. At the time, she mentioned that she planned a historical mystery series set in 16th century Poland-Lithuania. Because that time and place are very close to my own area of interest, I promised that we would talk again when the new series came out. In fact, the first book, Silent Water, appeared last year, and the second, Midnight Fire, has just been published. It opens with a journey. On the road to Krakow, early June 1545. We set out from Bari on a journey that we hoped would save our son's life toward the end of May in the year 1545. It was altogether different from the grand progress I had made 27 years earlier as a lady-in-waiting to the young Bona Sforza, heiress to the duchies of Bari and Milan. She was on her way to Krakow to meet her new husband, Zygmunt, King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania. We stopped in Venice to watch carnival festivities, stayed in Graz long enough for a hunt, and sojourned at the court in Vienna, where Emperor Maximilian treated us to a feast in a manner that befitted a future queen. At our final destination, we were greeted by cannons booming from the city walls, cheering crowds, and the entire Polish court awaiting us outside of Wawel Cathedral. This time we rode in a simple carriage as part of a train of merchants, stopping overnight at travelers' inns, eating the watery stews they all seemed to offer, or our own provisions, or whatever unspoilt food we managed to buy in villages along the way. But I was glad of the swift pace, for each day brought us closer to the renowned physicians at Krakow, who might be able to help our ailing boy. Glancing at Giulio as we rattled over yet another rutted road, I shuddered to see how frail he appeared. The recurring fevers that afflicted him, starting when he turned 4, had stunted his growth and weakened his limbs. He did not look like a boy of 9. How could he? He spent more time in bed than playing outdoors with other children. As a result, his skin had a pale, almost translucent quality, an effect only enhanced by his dark brown eyes with flecks of amber. Those eyes, so like his father's, glowed unnaturally large and bright in his thin face. My old friend Lucrezia Alifio, who still served as a lady-in-waiting to Queen Bona, insisted that the royal physicians in Poland could lessen his suffering, perhaps even cure him. Watching Giulio now, I hoped that this journey would prove her right, for none of the Italian doctors we consulted had succeeded in helping him. I also hoped that Lucrezia told the truth when she wrote that Her Majesty would be glad to see me, and happy to help my family in our predicament. And now, please join me in welcoming P.K. Adams. Hi, P.K. I look forward to talking with you again.
Hi, Carolyn. Thank you for inviting me back to your podcast.
Listeners who would like to hear more about how you became a novelist and your earlier books can listen to our previous conversation by going to newbooksnetwork.com and searching for your pen name. Let's start by talking a bit about 16th century Poland, which I think is quite unfamiliar to most of our listeners, even though it's contemporaneous with the Tudor monarchs in England, the Italian Renaissance, and Medici France, all of which attract an avid reader community. What can you tell us about the situation at the Polish court at this time?
The Kingdom of Poland and Grand Duchy of Lithuania, which formed a single political entity ruled by the Jagiellonian dynasty, was one of the largest monarchies of 16th century Europe, not just in the East, but anywhere on the continent. At its peak, the Jagiellonian realm stretched from the Black Sea to the Baltic, and its rulers were related by blood or marriage to all the other royal houses of Europe, in particular the Habsburgs. The 16th century was Poland's golden age, culturally and politically, a time when it was one of the leading continental powers, experienced a flourishing renaissance of her own, and enjoyed a relatively peaceful existence supported by strategic alliances with France and the Ottoman Empire.
Silent Water, which is the first book in this new series, opens in 1525 with the arrival of Bona Sforza from Bari. Who was Bona, and what brings her from Bari to Krakow?
Bona Sforza was an Italian noblewoman born in 1494 to Gian Galeazzo Sforza, the heir to the Duchy of Milan. Because his father was assassinated when Gian Galeazzo was only 7, his uncle, Ludovico Sforza, acted as regent and effectively wrested the power from his young nephew. Gian Galeazzo died in mysterious circumstances the same year that Bona was born, in 1494, and she moved with her mother, Isabella of Naples, to the city of Bari in the south of Italy, to be raised near her mother's family, who were the rulers of the Kingdom of Naples. Isabella and later Bona never reconciled themselves to the loss of Milan, and for years they tried unsuccessfully to regain the rights to the duchy. But despite that failure, the Sforza and Aragon blood made Bona one of the most eligible young women in Europe when she came of age. And so, in due course, her marriage to King Sigmund I of Poland, known in English as Sigismund the Old, who, by the way, was 27 years her senior, was arranged in 1517, at which point Bona left Bari for Krakow, which was Poland's capital at the time. And she was crowned the Queen of Poland in April 1518 at Wawel Cathedral in Krakow.
This brings us to the heroine of both of these novels, Caterina Sanseverino. Unlike Bona, she's a fictional character. Give us a sense of her backstory, her personality, and how she comes to be in Bona's entourage.
Caterina is a minor noblewoman and a young widow from Bari, the city where Bona grew up. Through her family's connection to Bona's mother's court, so the court of Isabella of Naples, Caterina secures a place in Bona's entourage when her marriage to King Sigmund is concluded. Caterina travels from Bari to Poland with the future queen and becomes her Lady of the Chamber. It's a high-level court position which entails direct service to the queen as well as being the supervisor of the queen's maids of honor. From the start, Caterina finds this position difficult, because firstly, it's unexciting, and secondly, at the age of 28, she feels she's too close in age to the girls she's supposed to supervise. In this role, she needs to be a disciplinarian first and foremost, but she finds herself sympathizing with the flirtations and the adolescent dramas of these young noble women who know that the course of their lives will be charted for them by other people. By their families, who will choose husbands for them based on the benefit these unions will bring rather than on affection. Caterina fundamentally deplores this patriarchal system, and as a result, during her time as the Lady of the Queen's Chamber, she feels constantly out of place and inadequate to the task.
And she herself is escaping what she anticipates will be not even her first arranged marriage, but another arranged marriage.
Right, yeah, because she is a young widow. And essentially at that time for a woman, there were two paths in life, either marriage or convent, right? So she knows that she basically has to figure out a way to avoid both. And serving the queen in this high position is a way for her to make her own way, you know, in life. But if that fails, then she would have to go back home and accept another arranged marriage. So the Lady of the Queen's Chamber is a position that she is she's struggling with. She's not happy with, but at the same time, it's a position that she really needs. So there is that conflict as well.
Before we move on to Midnight Fire, is there anything that you would like to share about this first novel in the series? I'm not talking about spoilers, but maybe some of the setup.
It's Silent Water, the first book in the series, revolves around a series of deaths that occur at Wawel Castle in Krakow during the Christmas season of 1519. The victims are courtiers who have seemingly nothing in common. And they come from different backgrounds, nationalities, they differ in age and their lifestyle, so much so that that the official investigators are stumped. Queen Bona, who is famous for having many political enemies, has her own theory as to who is responsible for these crimes. She's also perceptive enough to see that Katarina is not happy with her role. So one day she summons her, and saying that she has more sense than most men at the court, drafts her to help find evidence that supports the queen's suspicions. But when Katarina sets out to investigate, with the help of a handsome young secretary from the king's household, I should add, she soon realizes that the clues point to the queen's inner circle and that Bona's own safety may be at risk.
So as this is what I've heard from my introduction, Midnight Fire opens 20 years later, in actually a little bit more than 20 years later, because as you mentioned, it's 1518.
25, yeah.
Yeah, 25 mm-hmm. years later, right. In 1545, and Katarina is again traveling to Poland with her husband Sebastian and their young son Giulio. Where have they been in the interim, and what brings them back to Poland?
After the events of that winter of 1519-1520, described in Silent Water, Katarina finally decides that court life is not for her. She returns home to the south of Italy, and together with her new husband, Sebastian, settles on her late father's much diminished estate, and they become almond farmers. They have three children together, one of whom dies in infancy, and when their youngest son, Giulio, falls ill with a recurring fever that none of the local doctors seem to be able to cure, they decide to return to Poland to seek help from a royal physician at Queen Bona's court.
So how does she feel about returning to Poland after 25 years away? What is she anticipating might happen?
She is hopeful about finding a cure for Giulio, but she also dreads the memories that this journey may dredge up, the memories of the events described in Silent Water. I don't think she would have returned to Poland had it not been for Giulio's condition, but as a mother, she is willing to make that sacrifice and put herself in a vulnerable position in order to save her son.
So they go first to her husband's estate in Canary, but they soon visit Krakow, which is not far away and where they have family. And they've no sooner arrived in the city than Katarina receives news that she finds very shocking. What has happened?
On entering the city for the first time in 25 years, Katarina and Sebastian hear the mournful sound of church bells, and they learn that the queen has died. And so right off the bat, it seems that their plan is destined to fail even before they had a chance to set it in motion.
Here, Zygmunt August enters the story, and confusing as it is for the rest of us, Poland at the time had two kings named Zygmunt Stary, the old, whom you mentioned, and his son, Zygmunt August. Often they're both given as Sigismund or Sigismund Augustus in the Western sources. And they're both simultaneously King of Poland and Grand Duke of Lithuania. So for simplicity's sake, we'll refer to the father as the king and the son as the duke. But give us some insight, please, into how this situation came about and also into the personality of Zygmunt August as Katarina perceives him.
When the duke, Zygmunt August, was only 9 years old, his mother, Bona Sforza, decided to have him crowned king, even though his father was still alive, which is what led to this peculiar dual kingship. So the reason she did that was basically because she wanted to ensure an uncontested succession, even though Zygmunt August's right to the throne was never in doubt. It was a move that was supposed to, and in fact did, show the queen's power, but it earned her many enemies among the nobility, who saw it as usurping their authority to designate the new king. Katharina meets Duke Zygmunt August when he is 25 years old, already a king and a duke, as we said, and she quickly realizes, based on what she hears around the court and from her own observation, that he is spoiled, used to luxuries and self-living, and fond of women and entertainments. It is a picture that will become more nuanced as the story progresses, but that is her first impression, and it does have some amount of truth to it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The person who has died early on is Elizabeth of Austria, who was Zygmunt August's wife. And he is, to be blunt, not too upset by this death, or at least he gives no sign of mourning. What's going on there?
Zygmunt August was married to 18-year-old Elizabeth of Austria, as you said, who was a Habsburg princess, in 1543, so 2 years before the start of Midnight Fire. Elizabeth dies in 1545, just as the story begins. Zygmunt was not particularly upset by her death because that marriage had been arranged for political purposes, and he did not love Elizabeth, a feeling that I suspect was mutual. But that was also very common across the royal houses of Europe at the time, or indeed before and after the 16th century.
So even though they are mother and son, Queen Bona and Zygmunt August are not getting along at this point in their lives. What's the source of their conflict?
Bona was always very ambitious and interested in wielding power, which she did very well through through her husband, Zygmunt the Old, and later tried to do through his son when he came of age. But she met with resistance there, especially after Zygmunt August met and fell in love with Barbara Radziwill, a minor noblewoman of, shall we say, a colorful reputation. Soon he started talking about his desire to marry her. Bona was, of course, adamantly opposed to this union, and that led to a further and rapid deterioration of their already strained relationship.
And how does all this lead to Katharina traveling to Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania?
In Midnight Fire, Bona comes up with a plan to send Katharina to Vilnius to plead with Zygmunt August not to marry Barbara. She would do so at the same time as she sought a consultation with Zygmunt's personal physician for Julio's fevers. And so Katharina ends up on this dual mission, which has profound consequences for her personally because of her son's health, as well as for the future of the monarchy.
One of the advantages, if you could call it that, of her journey is that she is being sent with a royal escort, basically. And she undertakes this journey with two companions, Jakub Zaremba and the Marchesa del Vasto. Can you tell us anything about them as personalities and their role in the story?
So Jakub Zaremba is a Polish knight designated by Queen Bona to protect Katharina and her son on the road. journey in 16th century Poland or anywhere in Europe being quite dangerous for travelers. So he was basically her man-at-arms, her bodyguard on that journey. He's a few years older, he's a few years younger than Katarina and has an air of mystery about him. And given the precarious state of Katarina's marriage at that point, she finds herself attracted to him, even though, of course, her primary focus is her son and her mission for the queen. The Marchesa del Vasto, whose name is Maria, is Bona's distant cousin who provides Katarina with female companionship on the journey. Maria is a gossip and a chatterbox and serves to provide context and information on Barbara, on Duke Sigmund, and the various goings-on at the Vilnius court.
She's one of my favorite characters, actually. I really liked Maria.
I kind of do, too. I had fun writing her.
So you mentioned the precarious state of Katarina's marriage. What has caused trouble between her and her husband?
Julia's illness has put a strain on Katarina and Sebastian's marriage. From their interactions during the journey to Poland, we see that while they share the same preoccupation and the same goal, which is to find a cure for Julia, they don't have much time for each other anymore. Several times in the early chapters, Katarina muses about the intimacy they have lost and about the fact that they no longer talk to each other the way that they did in the early days of their marriage, openly and honestly about everything, whether happy or sad. In some ways, this journey and the next one that Katarina undertakes with Julia to Vilnius is a way for them to escape the quietly oppressive atmosphere in which their relationship seems to be stuck.
So what does Katarina find when she gets to Vilnius? How does the court there differ from the one at Wawel Castle?
The Vilnius court is younger, louder, and less formal than the one in Krakow. Zygmunt August has really freed himself from his mother's stifling influence, and he's just living a pleasure-filled life alongside his mistress, Barbara.
I'm not sure how much farther we can go without giving away too much. What would you like our listeners to hear about the central mystery of Midnight Fire?
As we already discussed, Katarina arrives in Vilnius on a mission to persuade Zygmunt August not to marry Barbara. But even before she has a chance to do so, a kitchen maid who serves Barbara dies of a poison that was clearly intended for the Duke's mistress. And so Katarina is thrust in the middle of an investigation in which Queen Bona is the primary suspect. Katarina doesn't believe that the queen is capable of something like this, and she is determined to find evidence to exonerate her. However, she soon realizes that in trying to clear Bona's name, she may be putting her and Julio's lives in grave danger.
Are there any other characters that you think listeners should know about? Did you want to tell us more about Barbara or her family, favorites of yours?
Actually, Barbara is a fascinating character in herself. There are many biographies of her and the relationship between her and Bona, which I kind of try to give a sense of in the story. But I think one of my favorite characters that we haven't talked about yet is actually Duke Sigmund's chamberlain, Piotr Opalinski. He's a secondary character, but I think very interesting because he is privy to the deepest secrets of the powerful, but must remain discreet and hide his feelings and opinions behind, you know, a mask of a diplomatic courtier, which I would imagine is extremely difficult to do. And he is Katarina's guide through the Vilnius court, kind of always in the shadows, but a very, very key secondary character in the story who makes, who really facilitates Katarina's work. He's a man she trusts the most, but so tangled is this mystery that even he doesn't escape suspicion at some point.
Yeah, I liked him very much. I think it might be worth mentioning because I'm sure a lot of people don't realize it. Although everybody at the two courts treats Barbara as some kind of hanger-on or, entirely inappropriate person. The main complaint against her is that by attracting Zygmunt August's interest, she is getting in the way of another political marriage, which is a kind of, you know, and that's how political alliances were made in that time. But she's actually from a very high ranking, probably the highest ranking family in Lithuania itself.
That's true, but it is not a royal family. It's an aristocratic family, but not a royal or a princely family. So that's one strike against her in Bona's book, who Bona being very mindful of proper hierarchies. And the other thing about Barbara is that she had a bad reputation. I mean, she was no virginal figure, which is what one expected from a prospective queen at that time. She had been married before. She had many lovers. There were just wild stories circulating about her, and how she conducted herself. Some of which probably were true, but I believe many were also invented. So there was just an air of scandal hanging around Barbara. So for these two reasons, you know, she was not seen by Bona or many other high court officials as the right material for a future queen. But Zygmunt was head over heels and would not be persuaded to part with her, which, you know, is kind of is an endearing, I guess, aspect of his character, that he could be that loyal to someone.
And he was more loyal than, say, Henry VIII. He didn't, you know, then execute her when he lost interest.
In fact, I write about this in the historical note to the book. He actually, after she died, he was heartbroken. She died fairly young, and he lived many years afterward, you know, later, for many more years after she died. And he was essentially in mourning for the rest of his life. He had the walls of his private apartment lined with black fabric, essentially. And he dressed, you know, in mourning attire for the rest of his life. So he was, you know, it really must have been for him a very affectionate and deep relationship, and, you know, certainly not anything that Henry VIII experienced with any of his wives.
So, as it should be obvious by now, that you're mixing historical figures and incidents with entirely fictional characters and stories, is it easier to write real people or imaginary ones?
Well, it's easier to write real people because there is a wealth of material about their personalities, habits, even their own words to draw from. But I think it's more fun to write imaginary ones because there's much less to be bound by. You can take what you want from real characters from that period and add or subtract or embellish to create characters that are really yours. So while both are rewarding, I think it's more entertaining to write fictional characters.
And in your plots, where do you draw the line between history and fiction? Because all historical novelists have to do that.
I always stay within the bounds of what's likely and believable. I don't want to create characters or situations that would not be consistent with the era in which they live. They have to act and think in the same way that people did in the 16th century, for example. Otherwise, they'll come across as too modern or too antiquated. Neither of these is a good thing. I want even my fictional characters to be so authentic that the reader will forget that they are fictional.
What would you like readers to take away from Silent Water and Midnight Fire?
I'd like readers to know that the royal courts of 16th century Poland, Eastern Europe, and Russia were every bit as exciting, glamorous, and full of intrigue and drama as that of the Tudors in England, the Borgias in Italy, or the Medicis in France. I think it's time for a broadening of the scope of English language historical fiction beyond these fascinating, yes, but somewhat overdone settings.
Do you already have plans for book three?
I do, and I'm planning to start working on it this fall.
I should mention that, although we met during our first New Books in Historical Fiction interview, you and I are now co-writing what we hope will become a mystery series of our own, set in 16th century Russia and Poland, Lithuania. Would you like to tell readers anything about that?
Sure. The Merchant's Tale is a historical adventure slash mystery slash romance set, as you said, in 16th century Russia. It features Tudor explorer Richard Chancellor on his first ever visit to Ivan the Terrible's court in Moscow. It was an accidental encounter after a part of Chancellor's fleet was shipwrecked in the White Sea while on its way to China. And it became highly consequential for Britain, Russia, and indeed for all of Europe.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, PK. It's really been a pleasure talking with you again.
Thanks so much, Carolyn.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with PK Adams about Midnight Fire, her latest novel. Find out more about her at www.pkadams-author.com. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at NewBooksHistFic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at www.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.